What is up, you pint pots? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's wildcard episodes, and we are proud to be doing the latest installment in our long and storied history of interviews here on No Holds Barred.
We are coming to you live from Baltimore, Maryland for this year's annual Shakespeare Theater Association Conference. And we have the pleasure of having some time now to sit down with fellow Bardophile and dear friend of the pod, Mia Gosling.
Mia is a former library cataloger turned the world's foremost, and quite possibly only, creator of Shakespearean stick figure webcomics. We are going to sit down and ask her 10 dual questions. 3 have come from Dan and I, and 7 are her favorites that have come in from you Bardflies as pulled from the first 85 episodes of the pod. So, without further ado, here we go.
2, 3, 4.
All right, so let's get right into it. This week we are thrilled to be graced with the presence of our first guest, Mia Gosling, good tickle brain from the internet. Mia, thanks for joining us here on No Holds Barred.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, as is tradition when we have guests on the podcast, we have a slew of dual questions that we're going to throw at you.
All right.
Good luck. May you do better with them than we do on a weekly basis.
So, to break it down a little bit, what we've done is taken all the dual questions we've been asked in the history of the podcast and sent them over to you in a luxurious email, well crafted by yours truly. And then Mia will answer 7 of her favorite questions that you all have sent in. So this is all the more reason to send better questions in the future so people have more things to answer. We'll start with one question, just basically, you'll see what it is in a minute. And then we'll have the 7 questions. And then Kevin and I both sent over 3 questions, of which Mia has chosen the one that she most wants to answer, giving us a total of 10 questions. That's the format how we'll do interviews.
Yeah.
As we always have done.
As is tradition.
Right.
So, Dan, why don't you lead off with the first question for this afternoon?
Sure. So, the first question will be, if your best friend were to describe you as a Shakespearean character, who would they choose and why?
Oh, God. I had a really hard time with this one because it's something that I've never actually thought about. But fortunately, I happen to be at a conference with a bunch of Shakespeare geeks.
Nerds.
So I did a little bit of canvassing last night just to get some ideas. Mm. And actually, the unexpected one that was given to me was Horatio.
Yeah.
I was thinking, oh, you know, you've got the fools, you've got like Rosalind and Violet and all the cool girls. But actually, the case for Horatio, that was pretty strong. He's observant.
Yes.
He's always there. He's watching what goes on. He's quiet, which I'm usually fairly quiet unless I'm, you know, led astray by bad company.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Not naming names.
It's okay, Kevin. At fear strikes out.
he's an observer. He looks at things. He processes things. He relays things, and he's the one who tells a story. And I feel like that's very much sort of what I do in my work. Is I'm looking at things and then I'm telling the story. I think I do it with a little bit more humor than Horatio. Although I had a past Horatio argue to me that Horatio actually does have a good sense of humor.
Good philosophy jokes. Make those philosophy jokes.
Yeah, he is an interesting character. I think he's rather subdued, not really flamboyant. He doesn't need to be the center of attention, and I'm usually more comfortable around the edges of a room. So I go with Horatio. I was thinking about Feste. Again, another observer, one with more wit, who likes to comment on the situations. But then someone pointed out to me that Feste also can be a bit of a dick. I'm not dickish.
No, and Feste, of course, Dan's favorite character, so that comparison is all the more apt. Moving on to the second question of the afternoon, this came from episode 20 from Manface12 on Twitter. What is the best play to convert to a big budget musical, big in all caps, full on 21st century, over the top, Taymor style directing the works?
Timon of Athens.
Of course.
Of course, the obvious answer.
Mostly because I would just love to see a big budget musical of Tynan of Athens. I haven't even stopped to think about what that would look like, but it would be amazing.
To ask a follow-up question, how many any budget productions of the straight play Tynan of Athens have you seen?
I've just seen one. Uh-huh. I'm going to see my second one this summer, and it's one of those plays which I've been dismissive of, I think, because it didn't click with me when I saw it, and I'm interested to see if a second visit to the play is going to change anything.
And you know what? Actually, that would be interesting. Is, you know, if the first act was the big budget musical element of it, and then in the second act when he's in the woods, it's like, nope, that's over. No. So the second act is like Black Box.
I need to see a big production number of Tymon in the hole with the with the Root and digging around.
I see.
Yeah,
I see. So we need a tone deaf, non dramaturged Broadway production.
Correct. That's what I'm looking for.
That sounds wonderful. What style of choreography would you like to have in that?
Oh, Fosse.
Nice.
It's the shoulders. I mean, I don't know.
Tymon just.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I feel that really complements Shakespeare's character work very well.
100%.
Bob Fosse is very flattered at the comparison.
So our next question comes from episode 46 from the Boston Angler himself, Liam Billingham. Which legendary production of Shakespeare that you've read or heard about do you most wish you had seen?
I wish I had seen Peter O'Toole's 1980 production of Macbeth, because apparently it was one of the most hilarious Shakespeare productions ever. It was, by all accounts, a complete flop.
Oh, perfect.
to the point where the audience was laughing uproariously where they shouldn't be laughing. Most notably, a great anecdote was Peter O'Toole insisted that there were buckets of blood, just absolute buckets. And so after the murder, he comes in at the top of these big stairs on stage, and he's drenched, completely drenched with blood, and he's holding the daggers, and the audience starts giggling. and they're laughing because it's so over the top. And so he waits for the laughter to subside, and then covered in blood, holding the daggers, he says, "I have done the deed." And apparently it brought the house down. And the entire production was, it wasn't intended to be funny,
right,
but it was just so bad that it was hysterical. And I would love to have seen that.
I've never even heard of that production.
Right?
I totally missed that.
You need to look it up.
That's hilarious. I wonder.
My friend Kate Pitt, who worked at the Folger, said that they have a lot of reviews of that production in their archives.
Interesting.
And I would love to read some of them.
So wait, where was that production?
It was in the Old Vic.
Oh, okay.
So that,
that's why I missed it also in 1980. But yes, also
obviously,
the travel.
Yes.
Right. The next question that came to us from at Nate Rouleau on Twitter: which Shakespeare play has the best fight or battle? What was the best Shakespeare fight that you've seen put up?
I think the best fight or battle is Hal and Hotspur in Henry IV, Part 1. And I think that just comes from these two characters being built up in opposition throughout the entire play. You have Hotspur, who you know is the best knight ever. He's the best warrior. He's the best fighter. And you have Hal, who's untested, but he wants to prove himself. So you have these two fantastically masculine, aggressive physical characters coming head-to-head at the climax of the play, and it's always just an electric fight scene. Mm-hmm. Probably the best individual fight scenes that I've seen have been those two characters. I've seen it done, you know, several full-on plate armor and broadswords, and then this last year I saw it done with each of them had a sword and a spear. And it was done in the round to the point where you're like, I'm glad I'm not sitting in the front row. Just so forceful. But in a general sense, in the Shakespeare fight scenes, I love all the battles in the history plays where people run on and then hit each other and then they run off and then they do it over and over again.
Yeah.
Those, I always love those.
We're in France now.
Exactly. Right. I believe the technical term is diverse alarums. And, and so those are, as a category of fight scene, those are my favorite.
Diverse Alarums would be a great name for a band.
Absolutely. It really would.
Thank you, Baltimore. We're out. We are Diverse Alarums. It'd be fun. It's also, it's really cool thinking about that. They're built up so well. When we did Messenger Day earlier this year, we get to see that in Richard II, Hotspur sort of starts to appear towards the end of the play. He doesn't do a lot in that play.
Yeah.
But he's there. And then that's the brilliance, is that he's Shakespeare's putting him just... Oh, it's like when you see go back and watch a TV series for the second time, you're like, oh my God, that guy was in that scene? He's mm-hmm. critical in the next play.
Yeah, he's introducing the minor character early on and then suddenly the twist.
Right. Fleshing it out. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And then killing him.
And then killing him off. Sells a lot of tickets. Mm-hmm. Right? So you've cleverly, now I'm seeing here, you know, what you're up to. This is brilliant. You answered this question with a history play. And then the next question you've chosen comes to us from Emily Gans via email, who asks, episode 70, yeah, is there a history play that you find a bit dull?
Well, Dan, I'm glad you asked me that. I in general, in principle, I hate to agree with you guys on things, but
that's
I
the
have
right
to
position to take.
I don't agree with that. I think you should always agree with us. That sounds fantastic. We're wonderful. Erudite humans.
Don't lie.
Okay. If I may come back in here.
1 second. So, before you...
No, go ahead.
I have seen 3 productions of Henry VIII, 2 on film and 1 in person.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there a Shakespearean play, history play, that you find to be a bit dull?
No. Oh. However, there is this other play that I've seen.
Okay.
It's kind of in the mold of a Shakespeare history play, except it's very dull.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it's called Henry VIII.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've seen 3 productions of it, and it has failed to capture any part of my imagination. I'd say that there's one scene in it, which is a trial scene with Catherine of Aragon, which it's the one bit that rings out to me.
Sure.
And the rest of it is just so tedious.
Is there a way to lift that scene out and put it with something else that works?
Like or in a better play?
It's just like, oh, what is this scene?
Yeah, I would love to watch that scene again,
right?
Without the baggage surrounding it.
What if we do Merchant of Venice, and then that's like the first trial? We just see like all the characters in Merchant waiting for their trial.
Like Portia on the way is right? Like, now I feel like I can do this, but I've never actually tried a case before. So let's give this a whirl.
Let's watch one. And then Catherine Aragon trial scene is just thrown in.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard of 3 productions of that play. Where did you see it?
Well, I watched the BBC Shakespeare TV adaptation of it. And then I saw Shakespeare's Globe, filmed their production of it. And then I saw one up at the Stratford Festival.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then that's about... Nobody's going to do it any better than that. So if those 3 can't pull it off...
Right.
The sad thing is, the next time a production of Henry VIII crosses my radar, I'm probably going to go see it again.
You're the eternal optimist. We respect that.
I suffer from my art.
Don't we all?
The next one up from episode 74, this came to us from @DylanCammerer, who was following up to a question from a previous episode. If you had access to Puck's love juice, what characters from the canon would you make fall in love? And after our heteronormative answers in that episode, Dylan wrote, what's up with the heteronormativity? What LGBTQ characters would you hook up with that love juice?
Well, I picked 2 characters from the same play. I think that Portia and Nerissa would totally hook up. They're very clearly have a very close friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And then they both go off. And they dress up as men,
mm-hmm.
and they have this very proactive, productive experience in court, achieving things on their own instead of being a daughter
mm-hmm.
or a servant or anything like that. And I just feel like those two, they also end up with fairly lousy guys.
Yep.
if it was me, I would not want to be with Bassanio.
I don't blame
or
you.
Or Gratiano. Right. And I just feel like those two, they've got a better life in store for them together, dressed as itinerant lawyers wandering the countryside, righting wrongs, solving injustices.
It's a sitcom I would certainly watch.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that is great. That's something that you could absolutely, I thought our answers were things that you couldn't actually, but you could end a production with that. That like, because it ends with them being like, I'll never lose Nerissa's ring. And it's like, you know what? You won't because I'm out.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's go.
That would be a way to improve the ending immersion for me, yes.
I think that's a very interesting take. I like that.
That is a play chock full of just people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like really overflowing with just bad humans. But we all have mercy for them because the quality of mercy, as we learn, is not strained.
Sure. Good.
So I've heard.
Great segue. Well, that wasn't really a segue.
That wasn't a segue. That was just a fact. It was a fact bomb.
And scene.
Okay. Fact bomb. Our next question comes to us from episode 83, which apparently is an episode you haven't listened to yet,
no,
but love the questions on.
Well, I'm a couple episodes behind, I'm afraid. So.
We'll take a pause here while we listen to these episodes.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed those episodes.
Oh, they were fantastic. Such insight.
So the question, this question comes from Redditor SecretlyBlue919, who asks, yeah, does reading No Fear Shakespeare make me a moron?
No.
next question.
Next question. Moving right along. No, it's obviously something that occurs to me a lot, thinking about what I do, which is to take Shakespeare and reduce it to the bare minimums. And I feel that there's no wrong way to engage with Shakespeare. You know, you've got Cliff Notes, what is it, Schmoop and No Sweat Shakespeare Online, and all of these things make hackles rise on various Shakespeareans to one degree or another.
Sure.
But I think anything that gets you to engage in Shakespeare is fine. Anything that gets you through the door is great. Like, for example, there's the whole manga series of Shakespeare manga comics. And I personally don't connect with them at all. Like, I can't read them. I get bored. I think there's too many pictures and not enough text to get the story across. And I think the text is, you know, badly chosen.
Yeah.
But some people love them, and I know there's tons of people out there who they just eat that up, and I think that's amazing. So, like, what works for you to be introduced to Shakespeare might not work for me. What works for me might not work for you, but anything that gets you interested in it, that helps you understand it better, is fine by my account. Yeah,
that's beautiful. You said something about getting to the bare minimum of Shakespeare, which is interesting because I think I've read your comics and learned more about some of the plays that I had from reading the play. Just, and it doesn't take 2 hours. It's three panels. And I go, oh, wow, how did I miss that?
Right.
And, you know, there is value in that, right?
Well, I think, you know, part of that is anytime someone does something like that to Shakespeare, you're not only getting the Shakespeare thing, you're also getting their viewpoint of it.
Right.
So I think, you know, you look at manga Shakespeare and you pick, they're very visually oriented. So you see the visuals that those artists and authors think are important, and that gives you something different. And you see my stuff, and I've got a different take on it. So I think, you know, you find what works for you and what speaks to you, and it's all great.
Yeah, awesome.
There are all these, yeah, right, all the different on-ramps, including, you know, listening to the two of us idiots, and now occasionally illustrious guests.
We have a guest. That's really rude to call her an idiot, Kev.
You're unbelievable. the last question from previous editions of The Duel also comes from episode 83. Yes. If you could memorize only one soliloquy, monologue, or sonnet, what would it be?
It would be the Salic Law speech from Henry V, which I have, in fact, memorized. And mostly I memorize it because it's just a great gag. I've memorized the speech, and I just... It's when anyone asks me what my favorite Shakespeare speech is, you can just launch right into it, and then everybody looks really terrifying.
Well, you realize that you're sitting in front of a microphone, and you're saying that you can just launch into it any time, so we're going to need to hear it.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yes.
How much time do we have?
You have 90 seconds left on this question.
Then hear me, gracious sovereigns, and you peers who hold yourselves your lives and services to this imperial throne. There is no bar to make against your highness' claim to throne but this, which they produce from Pheromond. In terum salicum mulieris ne succedent, no female shall succeed in salic land, which salic land the French unjustly glows to be the realm of France. Oh, God damn it.
That's why good. You never offer anything on this.
This is the problem. For the record, I do have the entire thing memorized, but this is the third day of the Shakespeare Theatre Association conference.
It's the fourth day.
Yeah, it is the fourth day, and I have for three nights been staying up way past my bedtime talking to these idiots.
Yeah.
And
right.
I'm afraid
how the tides have turned.
My brain has deteriorated slightly. But I will tell you later about Blithild.
Well, we could just do what we do in every production of Henry V and cut that monologue.
No. Unacceptable.
Perfect. So, I won the coin flip before the show and have the honor of asking
it's unbelievable.
The first of the... So, the questions so far, we had that opening question, which will be the blanket opening question for these.
As is tradition with all of our guests here. 100%.
Then the seven questions that came from the listeners... So, and as we've always done, what we'll do on the last two is just take questions that we've written, Kevin and I have written, specifically for the guest in the room where it happens. So the question I have for you, as a champion of midbrow arts, What are you able to do with Shakespeare that the older, more prestigious companies are not allowed to do?
I can do anything with Shakespeare. I think this is the fun thing is I'm a company of one. It is me and my pencil, and the world is mine oyster, as certain people have said. And I'm not constrained in any sort of way by budget, audience demands,
right.
Crowd, trying to please a crowd. So
it's
I can
never
just...
stopped us.
It's really not a fair question because I'm a completely different medium from Shakespeare companies.
Sure.
But I think what I can do is just totally be free in sending up Shakespeare.
Right.
I don't have to take it seriously at all. I don't have to be precious. I don't have to worry about upsetting the old patrons who come every year and want to see the plays that they know.
Right.
I can do whatever I want with it, and it's extremely liberating.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And please continue to do that.
Thank you.
And have, just, I guess, impromptu follow-up. Have you noticed that those older companies or the bigger companies go, oh, we love what you're doing, or do they go, wish you were doing something more like polished?
Everyone has been unfailingly positive and supportive of the work I've been doing, from the Stratford Festival down to, you know, companies that have like
us.
One,
yeah, just say it, us.
little tiny no-name companies. No,
sure, sure.
Yeah, no, but
companies like Seven Sages and Stratford, all the way down to all those other like the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Precisely, and just like coming to the Shakespeare Theatre Association conference is so great because it's the one time in the year when I get to talk to Shakespeare practitioners, people who spend their lives putting on Shakespeare shows, doing education and outreach with Shakespeare in schools, and it's the only time that I get to talk to these people in person and find out in what ways the comics that I've been drawing have been useful to them.
Cool.
And sort of get a feeling of how I'm doing, because it's sometimes very hard to do that when you work on the internet. It's kind of like living in a bubble, and it's so great to come here and be able to interact with people who are using and enjoying my work.
Yeah, awesome. And so to wrap, the 10th and final question will be the one that I sent you. So, as evidenced by the plethora of items available right now at the shop on your website at goodticklebrain.com, you've captured all of the different plays in a wide variety of ways. However, is there any element of Shakespeare's work that you have not been able to satisfactorily capture in your work, if satisfactorially is a word?
Satisfactorially, I think, is actually the...
That's definitely not it.
Okay.
You guys done? All right.
No.
I think the one missing piece from my work is really Shakespeare's language.
Oh, interesting.
And I mean, language is Shakespeare. It's such a his words are such a big part of what makes Shakespeare Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I use barely any of his words, which in one way is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to strip away what many people perceive to be the barrier to Shakespeare, which is the language.
Sure.
Or is at least perceived to be the barrier. And I'm stripping that away and presenting it in a way that is very easily digestible. However, the one thing that I'm always looking at is how can I engage with the language more? How can I make the language speak to people more using Shakespeare's words as opposed to replacing them with mine?
Right.
So that's something I talk to people here about and I've been brainstorming. So we'll see if I manage to get that language piece ever to work properly.
Have you ever thought about doing rolling up your sleeves and doing like a full that would be so, there's so many panels to do
like line by line?
Yeah, it'd be so much.
Just comic novel at that point, right? Graphic
well
novel.
You see, and I think that's it's almost too literal.
Yeah.
And at some point you need the words and the pictures to work to tell the story. You can't just regurgitate everything that's already on the page. So I don't think that would work so well.
Yeah.
But I always try to include nods to Shakespeare's language as much as
yeah.
I can.
Yeah, and I mean that's definitely, you know, that right, exactly, the nods are the references to the specific. I mean that's I noticed that a lot in your, you know, that you find the keyword, and that's what you, and it's like you can build a strip around that one word to be like, here's the word of the day is
right.
And I think that's something that I try to do in my work is if we're looking at a scene or a play and I give you just a 3-panel summary of a play, is that maybe with that knowledge, with that framework, you can go and then the language will make more sense because it will have something to land on,
uh-huh.
a sort of framework beautiful. That you can yeah. interpret the language. There's like, okay, I know at this point King Lear's going mad, so the words, even though I don't know all the words, I have the context right. for the speech, and I'm able to process it through that. So
yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It's all stuff that I'm working on, brainstorming on. So yeah. We'll see
you,
where it goes.
Are you able to, for the loyal Bardflies listening out there, give us any teases as to some of the things you've been brainstorming that may incorporate some more language?
No, because they're very much unformed at this point.
Perfect. Sounds great.
As your lawyer,
suck it, Bardflies.
So that's our full slate of questions. So now let's get to the important part, plugging your stuff. So you have, we can see all of your work. Where are you on all of the corners of the internet?
I am at Good Tickle Brain on all the corners of the internet because consistency is important.
Amen.
Absolutely.
As evidenced by our 11 different usernames.
Consistency is all I ask.
Give us this day our daily task.
For anyone out there, any of the Bardflies who aren't keen to you yet, if you're listening and you're not keen to her yet, what's wrong with you? just a bit of what is it that you do?
I am the artist and author of Good Tickle Brain, which is, as I always like to say, the world's foremost and very possibly only stick figure Shakespeare webcomic.
Find that corner. Hold that corner.
Yep. It's a niche market. And basically twice a week on my website, which is goodticklebrain.com, I post Shakespeare comics. And it ranges from anything from little one-shots making fun of a particular thing that I find amusing to right now, I've just started a whole scene-by-scene adaptation of Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, fantastic.
For the next couple months.
I know that face.
So for the next couple of months, you'll be able to follow along and see how Romeo and Juliet get on.
Wonderful.
It doesn't end well.
I hope it ends well. Oh.
It does not end
Spoilers.
Well.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. This is amazing. I mean, this is sort of the beauty of being at something like the Shakespeare Theater Association conference, is that we get to be in the same room as you. And I said before, now it's fallen apart. The fanboy element is just—it's very real.
No, it's totally true, and I feel the same way. That it's like, you know, we're trying to carve out our little niche, and it's like you're ahead of us every step of the way. So it is kind of it is an honor to have you here with us, and thank you for sitting down with we two promoters of the lowest brow arts.
That's right. Oh yeah, that's what I meant to say.
No, yeah, thanks for having me. I've been listening to this podcast. Well, I was late jumping on, but I've listened to almost all the back episodes, and it's just great fun to hear people who enjoy Shakespeare and who take Shakespeare with a grain of salt, who don't hold it as a sacred thing. And yeah. I think it's really fun to be able to talk to people like you guys most of the time.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
Take it. That's wow.
Most of the time it's over. That
really
pays
good.
Over.
Yes, thank you.
And just be able to share a love and a joy of Shakespeare.
Great. Yeah. Well, thanks. Do you have anything else, Dan?
Well, I have mountains of things, but I think we have time for them. So I'm going to go with no.
Okay, great. So then the last thing before we go, since you put up a comic about it this week and I asked you before we recorded and you have a microphone in your face, to resolve it once and for all so you don't have to say this again, for everyone's, how do you pronounce your first name?
Mia.
There it is. You heard it straight from the source. Thank you, Mia, for being with us here this week. And
I guess that's the show.
Cool.
Do we have an outro for this one?
No.
Great.
Adieu, 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 adieu.